You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. Welcome. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Autumn Shelton is showing us around her cannabis farm in Carpinteria. It's a small city south of Santa Barbara.
These ones are going to be more of like a dream walker, whereas the other ones, we have a strawberry banana. And so everyone will smell a little bit different.
It is an olfactory tour.
We even have one that's called GMOG, and that stands for garlic, mushroom, and onion. And it is quite a funky smell, but it is so popular.
Ah, weed. 5 years ago this week, we voted to legalize it, remember? And since then, the cannabis industry has ballooned, blossomed. And Carpinteria, a place previously known as the cut flower growing capital of the country, quickly shifted to become one of the cannabis capitals of the country. But growing cannabis comes with some stink, which led to a bit of stink over smells in Carpinteria. And 5 years in, that pungent marijuana smell is still causing divisions within this town. Here's KCRW's Catherine Barnes.
Back in 2017, during the first flowering of the cannabis industry in Carpinteria, I met Sandy Cutler. She lives less than a mile from a cannabis grow.
I have guests that come for the weekend and they tell me I have a skunk under my house. My granddaughter doesn't want to come because Nana's house smells.
There were times, she said, where it was like getting sprayed by a skunk. It gave her headaches and woke her up at night.
So those kinds of things do affect my quality of life.
The smell, among other things, divided the town for years. Take this 3-hour special city council meeting from 2019. Residents said they couldn't open the windows of their homes without the stink creeping in.
Smell is smell. Stink is stink. And we all stink.
Growers accused residents of falsely blaming weed for their asthma and other health issues.
If cannabis did not have an odor, then many of the ailments that some of our local citizens suffer would be blamed on other influences.
But Carpinterians did more than complain and point fingers. Over the years, they've made some changes. Which brings me back to Autumn Shelton and her 4 acres of cannabis plants. We exit the greenhouse and walk outside to check out the technology meant to address the smell.
This is our current odor abatement system, the Bayer Scientific Vapor Phase.
It's kind of like if you sprayed Febreze all along the roof of your house 24/7. The vapor, known as Ecozorb, gets piped around the perimeter of each greenhouse, neutralizing odor compounds from cannabis as they sneak out of the vents. The technology is used in similarly smelly industries, like liquid waste plants and meat processing facilities. Walking around the property, it sounds like a faint, continuous hissing. Installing odor abatement technology like this one has gone a long way in making Carpinteria less stinky. But the problem persists. According to members of the County Planning and Development Department, Carpinteria residents have filed 959 odor complaints in the past year, or roughly 2.5 complaints a day. And residents say the county mostly ignores them.
There has not yet been an enforcement because of odor, not in 5 years.
That's Rob Salomon. He's a board member of the Santa Barbara County Coalition for Responsible Cannabis, a nonprofit that recently went from suing cannabis growers to trying to work alongside them. In August, the coalition signed an agreement with its former adversary, CARP Growers, an interest group that represents the owners of 23 cannabis properties, the large majority of grows in Carpinteria. The agreement includes a rapid response to odor complaints, something he says the county's current system fails to do.
My view of government is they don't move very fast. So if I make a complaint of odor on Tuesday at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and somebody doesn't get out there until Thursday morning at 7, everything has changed. So it's very unlikely there's going to be a validated odor complaint. If it's not validated, they don't do anything. The way we've done it is if there's an odor incident, there is a response, period.
Under the new plan, a resident can make a complaint to CARP Growers, who will then pinpoint where the smell is coming from. If the culprit is one of their member farms, that owner must make changes to their odor abatement system or risk getting kicked out of the group. If the growers hold up their end of the deal, the coalition agrees not to oppose or appeal any more of their projects. This is an example of two opposing groups joining forces to cut out the middleman. In this case, the slow-moving bureaucracy of county government. But not all locals are confident this agreement will really change things, in part because there's been no public outreach beyond a press release. No one's quite sure what number to call or why this process is any better than making a complaint with the county. Plus, the agreement calls for wind monitoring stations meant to identify each smell complaint, but those aren't up and running yet. And new carbon scrubbing technology that may work better than vapor for eliminating odors is stuck on a cargo ship somewhere out at sea.
I applaud the intent behind it. At the end of the day, the proof will be in the pudding, so to speak.
Maureen Claffey's family owns an avocado orchard next door to a cannabis farm represented by CARP growers, which she says still stinks. She's fed up with the lack of enforcement on the side of the county, just like Salomon. But she doesn't think this agreement has any real teeth either. In fact, she sees this kumbaya ceasefire moment as a publicity stunt crafted by deep-pocketed cannabis growers.
I feel like the public only has a short attention span. And if they see all this PR machine spinning this good news, they think the problem has been solved and they're walking away. But at the end of the day, nothing has really improved.
Plus, she views the odor as the canary in the coal mine. She's concerned about how cannabis grows are impacting air quality, water quality, and public health, environmental factors that have not yet been locally and objectively studied. Claffey has spoken up about this at county and school board meetings, calling the vapor technology toxic and criticizing the school district for taking what she calls bribes from growers. As you might suspect, these opinions have not made her the most popular person in town.
I've been trashed on Facebook. I've had friends tell me my daughter can't play with their daughter anymore because of my beliefs on this. When I was on the school board, I was massively attacked.
She says it got to the point where she and her family moved off their farm and resettled nearby.
Our solution was to leave. You know, we left Carpinteria. We left the school district. I just didn't feel safe.
In other words, while some like Salomon are trying to strike deals with former opponents, others like Claffey are continuing to fight, despite the consequences. So after 5 years, millions of dollars worth of smell abatement technology, and a whole lot of complaints from residents, Carpinteria still hasn't found a way to live peacefully with the greenhouses that make the city a marijuana powerhouse. But let's end on a bit of good news, shall we? Sandy Cutler says it has gotten better at her house since 2017. She still does get whiffs, but nothing too bad. And when in doubt, there's always the beach. That ocean breeze washes the smell right away. For KCRW, I'm Catherine Barnes.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with KCRW's Greater LA, Steve Chiotakis here. There is no shortage of deep, nuanced portraits of Los Angeles and its diverse cityscapes on television lately. Insecure delves into South L.A. Never Have I Ever navigates the depths of the San Fernando Valley. Curb Your Enthusiasm, of course, skewers the West Side. And Hentified brings Boyle Heights to life. Now, that show follows three cousins, Anna, Chris, and Eric, as they chase their version of the American dream and try to protect their grandfather, their abuelo, Casimiro, whom they lovingly call Pop. The family struggles with the pending closure of the restaurant, Mama Fina's, and the looming threat of Pop's deportation. And the rich storyline follows multiple generations of the family, rooted in East L.A., a place that is changing right before their very eyes.
So you grew up in the mean streets of Boyle Heights, eh? Where you from, pinche Bato Loco? Where you from, Bato?
All right, we get it. You saw Blood In, Blood Out. Relax.
That's because you're not from here, Chris. You grew up in a cul-de-sac in Idaho. I was running up and down First Street. I was tagging Mariachi Plaza, and I painted that f***ing sign by hand.
The second season of Hentified premieres tomorrow on Netflix. Marvin Lemus and Linda Yvette Chavez created the show and for the first time directed a few episodes of season two as well, and they both join me right now. Welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having
us. Thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to be really careful about the clip we introduced y'all with because I don't want to give anything away, but there are some twists and turns away from season one that I didn't really see coming. What do you say to the fan who's like, where can this possibly go?
Well, yes, I think that's going to be a little bit of the hallmark of the season is that we definitely let things tell the story the way they want it to be told. So there's a lot of ins and outs and a lot of unexpected things, but I think at the heart of everything is a family trying to stay together in the midst of some hardship, but at the same time, enjoying life and trying to have their joy and stay together as much as possible. So we have some really beautiful episodes that are holidays, and we have, you know, our cousins struggling to persevere in spite of all of it, and we still have a lot of jokes. So I think it's a lot of ups and downs, but I think that they're very interesting ups and downs that challenge our characters in really interesting ways.
And we know Pop is reunited with the family after being taken by ICE. We know there's a threat of deportation, and we know that Mama Fina's days are numbered. At least they are for now. I mean, that's the one thing that's consistent here. The business on the cusp of going away, finding new ways to market traditional Mexican food. How much, Marvin, how much of an allegory is the story of Mama Fina's when it comes to the battle between old East L.A. and the newer hipster gentrifying one?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a pretty allegorical for a lot of different things. I think at the center of the story for every single character and for every storyline is this question of where do we belong? And I think, you know, as first-gen children of immigrants and immigrants themselves in this country, it's a question that we kind of encounter and deal with at some level every single day. And, you know, this shop at the center of the family that has been the, you know, the Pop's American dream and that has helped fuel the American dream for the generations after them really stands in for our home that we see changing before us. You know, it's this city that we have grown in, that we've come to love, and in neighborhoods that in a lot of ways generations past were forced to live there. It was the only place we could live that we were redlined into. And then to have it all kind of changing underneath our feet without so much as having a say in it, I think it really does stand in for just so many of the issues and the layers that every single person, every character in the family is dealing with. And we try to represent so many different facets of different characters and folks in the community that we see that are dealing with this in very different ways, and some that are benefiting, others that aren't, and some that are right in the middle trying to figure out, like, can I and should I? Like, does that make me some sort of a sellout, or does that mean that I'm just chasing this American dream and doing what, you know, everything my parents and my grandparents sacrificed for me to be able to have? And that internal conflict, I think, is always at the center of the show.
Linda, the people who have been in Boyle Heights for generations, I mean, they have a place, whether it be Mama Fina's, a taqueria, or a house, a plot of land, even a neighborhood. But people who might be priced out of other parts of town, like Silver Lake or the West Side, Echo Park, you know, they think Boyle Heights is more affordable. They might even see, like Vivian, right, who bought Mama Fina's, a chance to profit. The Soul Cycle yoga doing Vivian, I mean, you know, who drives a Tesla. And by the way, you know, that's not only Boyle Heights, that's South LA, that's Inglewood. There are so many communities who are experiencing the same thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, there's so much, it's crazy because there's so much tragedy happening in so many areas that I think we love that we've grown up in or grown up around. I grew up in LA County, grew up in Norwalk, which also went through its own gentrification. And my family was predominantly from East LA. They immigrated to East LA, but there's so many neighborhoods in LA County, and not only LA County, but the Bay Area, Oakland, New York. Like, when we first released season one, the amount of people who responded with, can you make a series about our neighborhood? This is what's happening in our neighborhood. I was just in Austin and a young woman came and said, I came just to see you because when I saw this show, I thought, oh my God, this is what happened here. This is the change that's happening every day. And the way that communities of color are being pushed out of their neighborhoods, it's just so, so wrong and so tragic. And I think for us as artists, we wanted to create a show that could really spotlight or communicate, humanize exactly what's happening. And the Morales family for us was having a representation of families that are really out there trying to survive gentrification and change and systemic, institutionalized xenophobia and racism and classism. These are working class communities and families, and they're everywhere. And to be able to humanize them, I think, gives not only a sense of representation for those who are experiencing it, but also allows others to see these are not just numbers. These are not just change happens and like, let's just move on and not think about it. These are real people. And it forces people to kind of really internalize and process how they are moving within their neighborhoods, moving from one place to another. How are they investing in real estate? How are they doing it responsibly? And I think those things are good things for everyone to be talking about. And for us, you know, the gray areas of that is where we like to play with it so that there's a discourse that can happen.
You talk about, you know, people who call you or write to you from different locations. Can you tell the story, Austin or, you know, New York or wherever it might be? But how do you think someone in Iowa, you know, or someone in South Alabama would look at a story like this? Why do you think it's a story that they should know?
That's a really great question. Yeah, I mean, my best example that I always go to is that same, like, the way that we're, like, how are we able to relate to Star Wars and all of the crazy languages that are in those movies and the specific techno babble that they have throughout the series. And I mean, it's one of my favorite things in the world, but I relate to it so much because at the core of it is just the very human condition of, you know, of hope, of it's all those human stories. And I think that is ultimately here. I think for such a long time, this industry has said, like, oh, we can't, people don't want to read subtitles, which has been disproven time and time again over the recent years with stuff like, you know, Parasite and even this show being able to be bilingual. It's at the heart of it, like Linda's saying, it's a human story. It's a very universal story of trying to just figure out how to have your American dream and honor your family and where you come from. And I think that's something that, I mean, I don't know anybody that can't relate with that.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is, you know, Marvin talks about this a lot, about like Latinx is not a genre. So the show is at the heart of it. It's a dramatic comedy about a working class family, like that's running a restaurant. The number of people I've had who've spoken to us about just being able to relate to this family running a small business and trying to survive is just so universal. And I think it's true of so many working class families, whether you're Latinx or not. Anywhere across the country, and we've gotten folks who've reached out to us who are non-Latinx, who are like, oh my God, this is my grandmother, this is my father. And one of the things that we got in terms of feedback from Netflix after it dropped was how it activated responses to the show in areas of the country that they never expected, like places like, you know, areas of Texas or the Midwest and places that they didn't expect would be watching the show. And for me, I think it's one, it's a family trying to make it, which is like, who can't relate to that? And it's a working class family. And there's a lot of folks in this country who are working class and who are trying to survive, especially during a time that's so difficult right now.
Marvin, there are also subplots here that involve LGBTQ issues, the character of Anna, which in some Catholic homes can be taboo, right? And, you know, I wonder how and why you wanted to approach that and whether you looked at it in a specific way.
Yeah, I think, you know, it was very important to us to have, you know, representation of just like so many of the different intersections of communities within just even the Latina community itself. You know, Lynn and I have a lot of queer friends and family. And I know for myself, like I have my sister, you know, there's a lot of influence in Anna from my sister in the early stages of the show and that story. And I think the approach that we wanted to take that was important to us was to let the character be queer without it being the story of her coming out or the story of her dealing with being accepted within her family. Like that was we like skipped that part of the story and just let her be, and just to be able to show this representation within this family of like, okay, we've accepted her. We love her. This is who she is. And now the issues that we're dealing with Anna are other issues. And we've gotten so much positive feedback for that, for being able to just show queer characters in the show that are existing. They're existing and they're dealing with all sorts of other facets of their life and trying to just, you know, make their American dream happen.
One of my favorite, I just wanted to add, one of my favorite pieces of feedback from after season one was someone posted that they had seen the series with their parents. And when they came to the queer scenes with Anna and Jessica, they freaked out. They were like, oh, I don't know what my parents are going to say after this. And they said that right afterwards, they asked their mom, like, oh, is that okay? And their mom said, love is love, mija. And I think that was, she was shocked that her mom even said that they had never really had the conversation. And she didn't really even realize that her mom was okay with it. And I thought that was so beautiful, you know, that the show could be a place for them to have that conversation, to have that acceptance feel so normalized, was a beautiful thing to be a part of.
Linda, did you always want to do this? Were you rooted in your environment? You said you have, you know, you go back to East LA, your family generations back, and then to Norwalk. Did you feel like there was a place for you and a place for this story in episodic, you know, scripted television?
I mean, it's crazy. I don't think I did for a long time. I went to film school. I went to USC film school. And for many years, I really was trying to find a place for Latine storytelling, for the stories that I wanted to tell. My background in undergrad was in comparative studies and race and ethnicity, and my focus was literature and the arts and communities of color. So I came out of college like ready to do my art with activism. But what I found in the industry was not an industry that was ready for that, was ready to tell those type of complex stories, nuanced stories. I mean, there's scenes in season one that like I would have never imagined in a million years we'd be able to tell on television. But they were things I wanted to see. I definitely were the stories I wanted to see on screen that I was missing, that I was craving and hungry for. But here we are. I mean, you know, we did season one really during the Trump years. And it was a time that opened up, strangely, a lot of doors, because it opened up a lot of people's minds and hearts and understandings around a lot of the complex issues that we were trying to talk about. The industry now is not the same industry that it was 4 years ago, and it won't be the same one in another 4 years. And I'm just grateful that we get to be a part of this wave.
That's what I want to ask you. I mean, most of the people at the helm with Hentified are Latinx. I mean, do y'all think it's gotten better for Latinx writers and producers and showrunners? And, you know, America Ferrera is the exec producer. You know what I'm saying? It's like you don't see that kind of cast of characters, that kind of, you know, those credits on a lot of shows. But it seems like it's changing. Do you think it is, Marvin?
I think it's definitely changing. I mean, we had the premiere event just recently for the show, and that same night there was the premiere for the new Disney movie, the Encanto movie, and then the night before there was a Ida Rodriguez's stand-up special, and there's the new head of the class. And I just, like, you know, like literally yesterday was looking at all this stuff coming in. I was like, yo, what? There's a lot. Like, what's going on? There's just so many things coming out. But of course, there's still so much more to grow. There's still so much more to get to for more inclusive storytelling. I mean, within the Latina community and just POC in general. I mean, we wanting to see more Afro-Latinx storytelling, more indigenous storytelling. Like our story, this East LA Chicano story, is just one very specific point of view that Linda and I know intimately, because that's our identity and that we wanted to write to. But I definitely have been noticing just in these last weeks that I'm like, yo, things are starting to change, because I've never seen this many shows. Like even when just from last season, when we first premiered, there was only like two or three other things that existed with a Latinx cast the way that this show has. And so It's definitely changing, but I would say that there's plenty of room to keep getting better.
Well, congratulations to you both on season two. Let's hope for more seasons, even beyond number two. Lindy Yvette Chavez, Marvin Lemus, creators, showrunners, writers of Gentified, and season two premieres tomorrow on Netflix. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much.
Glad you came along with us for Greater LA. We're back tomorrow. It's the first effort in LA and one of the largest in the country for universal basic income. Meet some of the folks living in poverty in South Los Angeles, vying for $1,000 a month, no questions asked, and what they would do with that money. That is yours tomorrow. Join us on the interwebs, won't you? At kcrw.com/GLA. Subscribe to the podcast. Get it delivered fresh to your device, whatever that device may be, and hear the show every time we carefully and tastefully put it together. kcrw.com/greaterLA. Catherine Barnes, Rebecca Mooney, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on the show this evening. Thank you for your ears and for your time and attention. I'm C.J. Takis. Have yourself a great night.